This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Hello, how's your Thursday going? Great to have you here on the Country Hour today. Shortly talking about lamb slaughter rates here in Western Australia at the meatworks, which have dropped 43% in recent weeks due to COVID-related staffing problems. Talking about that in some more detail with Stephen Bignell from Meat and Livestock Australia. Also today, you're going to finally get the chance to hear Labor's agricultural policies in the lead up to the federal election.
Yes or no? At the last election, Labor had a policy to phase out the live export of sheep. Is that still Labor's policy?
Well, I'm not going to be making policy announcements in the interview today, Kath, and we're talking to people about...
Well, you are going to hear from the opposition agricultural spokesperson, Julie Collins, and I'll be very keen to hear what you think of her answers to questions relating to Labor's agricultural policies that it plans to take to the federal election. You'll hear from the Shadow Ag Minister just after 12:30 today. So be part of that conversation on text 0448 922 604. 12:06 here on the ABC. And this week on the Country Hour, you've been hearing stories about big business interests in small regional communities. Andrew Forrest has recently purchased another 3 cattle stations in the northwest, and you heard about the renewable energy hub plans for one of them from his company Fortescue Future Industries. But the mining billionaire isn't the only company knocking on homestead doors. Our Pilbara reporter Michelle Stanley has been speaking to people involved in the pastoral industry. Michelle, what are you hearing about who is interested in land in the north?
The big one, of course, Belinda, is Andrew Forrest. He now has interests in 20% of the stations in the Gascoyne. He also owns all but 2 stations between Carnarvon and the Nanyatara Roadhouse, so quite a big stretch of land there. And on top of that, he's recently purchased stations in the Eastern Pilbara and the East Kimberley for his pastoral businesses. There are other companies, though. So in terms of the ones looking to generate renewable energy, wind farms, solar farms, things like that, I've been told of Total, Capricorn, Pearl Energy and Province Resources looking for land, potentially for wind turbines. And then Woodside, Green Collar, AAC and, of course, Fortescue Future Industries as well, looking to sign contracts with pastoralists for carbon farming on parts of their stations. These are big contracts, Belinda. I've been told we're talking millions of dollars each year.
So it's a mix of buying the stations and also leasing the land. What's the community reaction been to this?
It's been really mixed, and no one seems to be all in one camp either, which is really interesting. So looking at some of the positives, no one wants to turn down investment in their region. That sort of spending on infrastructure and development is really exciting for some people. It can also bring a new form of income for locals. So whether they are signing up parts of their land for carbon contracts or otherwise, there can also be contracting opportunities with fencing or putting in fire breaks or just other odd jobs on a station. A few people have commented online about the stations, the positive in the case of Emu Creek, Ellavalla and Yalbalgo, people saying they're really happy about it because they are Australian owned and they've not been sold to international companies or people. There's also the positive in terms of the actual sale of the stations, because, I mean, if you don't have a succession plan and a billionaire is willing to give you a bit more for your station than you might be able to get on the open market, it's a good deal for you. It also heats up the market a bit more generally. So I've heard countless stories of increasing prices for pastoral land. And one station I was told sold for $4 or $5 million in that West Pilbara area, and the locals were just gobsmacked at that price.
Yeah, but that's also a negative, isn't it?
Yeah. If you're hoping to snap up some land in the Pilbara, you might want to add an extra zero to your offer or maybe look somewhere else. Some people have said that the current prices are just not realistic. So families, people are unlikely to be able to afford to buy into the Northwest. That also goes to that next point about community. So the more corporates, the fewer people involved in a community. One criticism I've heard quite a bit from the stations owned by Andrew Forrest is that, yes, the staff do go to rodeos, they go to Busy Bees and Gymkhanas, but they don't volunteer their time on committees. They don't share knowledge and information about the region. They keep to themselves quite a lot. And it's something I raised with Maya Schweitzer from Fortescue Future Industries. When you're talking about the broader benefit to the pastoral industry, for example, how do you plan to work not just for the contracting side of things, but to really be part of a community in the pastoral industry in the north of WA?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I think it starts with having managers on site. So I think one thing that we've heard really clearly from engaging with pastoralists across the region is, you know, even just with the recent bushfire season, how important it is to have a certain, you know, density of community that can come together and help fight bushfires on neighboring stations. And just what a incredibly strong tradition that is, to look after your neighbors, knowing that they will look after you when it's your time of need. So we're really conscious of that, being part of that, being part of that community. You know, unlike an oil and gas development or a mining development, a renewable development is for generations. The wind will always be good here. And so we really need to go in with that mindset of being good neighbors for generations, not just during construction, not just up front when the contracts are being written, but actually for the decades ahead.
One other point on community is the tourism businesses. And a few people have commented they're disappointed Emu Creek Station is closed. Maya Schweitzer from FFI, who you just heard from, she says there are plans to reopen it, but she wasn't sure when. So I guess when companies have renewable energy hubs, cattle, you know, agriculture to manage as well, a big question is how much will they invest in tourism? So we'll have to wait and see. The last major concern is around the environmental side of things. It sounds great to be producing renewable energy or offsetting carbon, but to have wind turbines and solar panels and thousands of hectares of land cleared for them, it'll completely change the face of the land forever. And people will have to accept it, I've been told. The question is, how much are people prepared to change that landscape for the benefit of producing green hydrogen? Maybe the answer is completely, but maybe it's not.
12 past 12 here on the Country Hour, and just talking about how really big business is coming to town, some small regional communities here in Western Australia. Just one example we've heard this week, Andrew Forrest recently purchasing another 3 cattle stations in the northwest of the state, and you heard about the renewable energy hub plans for one of them through his company, Fortescue Future Industries. Michelle Stanley has been looking into this story in a little more detail. And Michelle, what are people saying about how the companies are dealing with the landholders?
I would imagine it would be quite intimidating as a pastoralist whose main job it is to run cattle. You're now faced with salespeople knocking at your door, big contracts with a lot of fine print, and it sounds like there are a lot of companies knocking too. So I've heard a bit of concern about that, about the fine print of carbon contracts in particular, and what they would be signing up for. One person said to me it looked great, but when they sent the details to a lawyer, the lawyer had big concerns about just how much control the companies would have. So if the station doesn't hit the carbon targets, for example, the companies might be able to get more involved into the day-to-day running of the station, maybe force them to sell off stock, for example, or potentially even sue the pastoralist for not hitting targets. So it's a big unknown. Also, the style of communication people were uncomfortable with. They were saying that the ones who go to lawyers, they get told their lawyers don't know what they're talking about. The people who aren't going to lawyers are getting hassled until they sign a contract. Pastoralists in the north have formed a new group so they can work together to try to deal with some of these emerging industries. They're hoping to have maybe more of a voice to stand up and really be in those conversations with big business and with government.
And Michelle, why is this all happening now?
Well, it was just a couple of years ago that carbon farming wasn't an option in WA. Now it is possible, and there's a big focus from companies on net zero targets. So Fortescue Future Industries will talk very proudly of its net zero by 2030 plans for the mining operations, FMG's mining. A lot of other companies have similar plans. Net zero by 2050 is another big one. The big thing to remember, though, and you spoke about this on the Country Hour just a couple of days ago, Belinda, these giant companies are going to landholders to hit their carbon targets, to fill their requirements. But what about your own? A few people told me they're starting to realise their own beef will soon need to be carbon zero. Richard Heath is the Executive Director of the Australian Farm Institute, an independent ag policy research organisation. And Richard says there are big benefits to building carbon in your soil, and pastoralists and farmers really need to look after themselves first.
The second benefit, which is really rapidly emerging and becoming quite obvious, is the need to demonstrate carbon neutrality in supply chains to be able to continue to access markets. After that, you know, after you've taken care of all of those aspects, then there may be some opportunity for any additional carbon that might be generated, which, to be honest, in most farming systems, unless you are completely changing practice and going to permanent vegetation or something like that, it's unlikely that there will be too many extra carbon, you know, too much extra carbon still in the system, additional carbon, that you can then look for an opportunity in a market for.
Michelle, what are the regulations around this industry and how are they making an impact?
Well, the big one is the Pastoral Lands Board. The PLB has to give approval to allow stations to be purchased. So there may be a point the PLB says, no, this is not in the state's interest or the industry's best interest, and it might put a stop to things. There's also a review into the Land Administration Act at the moment, and some people are concerned changes might make it easier for companies to snap up land. So the landholders are watching that one very closely. There's also the power of veto we've talked about a bit on the Country Hour this week. So the Agriculture Minister is able to veto carbon farming projects if they believe the project will have an adverse impact on agricultural production or regional communities. So that's for projects of more than 15 hectares or more than one third of a property. But the regulation side of things is a really big unknown, and it is something that's worrying some landholders, that if they are to sign and regulation changes, where does it leave them? Particularly if they sign big contracts, which open them up to litigation. We also have an election soon. So if there is a change in government, could that see a change in rules around carbon farming and renewable energy production? It is a big question, and some aren't willing to risk it.
Just finally, Michelle, did you check in with the farm lobby groups here in WA just to see what their thoughts are around this?
Yeah, I did, because I've spoken with a lot of people the last couple of days who aren't keen to put their voice on this story. They are a little bit nervous. I asked them who they would like to hear from, and a few said the PGA. I contacted the Pastoralists and Graziers Association, and they said they did not want to speak about this topic.
All right. Any reason why?
No, they just said, look, it's not something we're going to talk about at the moment. So I think that's why you see these pastoralists coming together to form their own groups, so that they can have their voice heard on a bigger scale.
Yeah, really good to hear those details. Thank you for that, Michelle. Really appreciate it. Michelle Stanley reporting in on when big business comes to town, and there is a lot of big business having a look around pastoral areas and agricultural areas at the moment for all sorts of projects, whether it be wind farm, carbon farming, green hydrogen. There's a lot of activity going on. And a few Facebook comments too to report. These are from the ABC's Pilbara Facebook page. Joan says, good on you, Twiggy, doing something that previous and current state governments won't do. And Kay responded to say, sure, he will be doing it for financial reasons. He doesn't do much unless he gains. Pam says, let's hope they are cared for, as Andrew Forrest implies he will. He's one smart man, setting the state for better energy options and be the only provider. Ka-ching! This from Peter, what happens when he owns all the stations in the north? And KV says it won't be long, and the only people who will own anything will be the billionaires. A few people like Anna Kim speculating that Andrew Forrest is purchasing the land not for green energy purposes but for future mining, and plenty of people saying that it's a positive to be Australian owned and not an international buyer, and plenty disappointed the Emu Creek station is staying closed. Really keen to hear your thoughts, the pros and the cons of the big players, the billionaires, the big corporates investing in WA's farming and pastoral properties. What do you make of it all? The text 0448 922 604 to have your say on the text this afternoon. It is 20 past 12. Well, WA isn't the only state to have caught the eye of big companies looking to explore and invest in rural and regional Australia. So let's take a look around Australia and see what's going on and maybe learn from that experience. In Queensland in 2013, an independent statutory body, Gasfields Commission Queensland, was established to facilitate trustworthy relationships and respectful communication between the state's onshore gas, agriculture, business and government sectors. The Commission's CEO is Warwick Squire. Warwick, what's the first thing that farming families want to know when the big end of town comes knocking on the door looking to do a deal? And, you know, that could be a gas exploration, a carbon farming project, or even a big renewable energy program. What do they want to know?
Oh, what does it mean for me? As a landholder, does it mean that, you know, will I be forced into a sale? How does land access occur? It's all about rights and how the process of the interaction with the company will occur. So that's been that's the real touch point here. And in Queensland in gas, we have regulatory protections for landholders about, you know, how those interactions with the companies occur, what is the process, how is compensation calculated, you know, how is land accessed, making sure you're managing those concerns to landholders, biosecurity risk, minimising the impact, those kind of things. I guess the other concerns, and something that I've seen raised in the context of your experience in Western Australia, is what does it mean in a community sense? You know, we have a traditional community built on family farming operations, and you've got a large operator moving into the area. Are they going to participate in the community or be, you know, potentially be an outsider? That's where we've seen a lot of change over the last decade in Queensland, where we talk about the concept of social license to operate for the companies. And that really hinges on them being perceived and welcomed as part of the community rather than an add-on to the community. So they've invested locally. The community sees the benefits that the company brings through its operations, jobs, services, infrastructure upgrades, those kind of things. Where we've seen those companies invest in local communities, we've seen that social license blossom and become a real part of that community.
So that's been something that's developed over the years that wasn't there right from the start?
No, it wasn't there right from the start, and it took some time and some reform in the sense of policy and legislation to compel in some cases a greater social responsibility. But, you know, over time, the companies have very much matured their approach to dealing with communities and have recognised the value in investing in those communities. It's not just about, you know, the dollars that go in and the better roads, but, you know, the actual acceptance that can bring from a community perspective.
Is there still...
In the mining industry, and I'm sure it's the same in WA, that is a very well-trodden concept around that social license and local investment.
Is there still concern around agricultural land and the use of that land and sort of the eating away, I guess, of that land to other industries?
Wherever there's a competing land use issue matter, like, for example, gas and agriculture, there is that concern. Again, that's something that's sought to be managed through the regulatory framework in Queensland, where there are higher levels of protection for some areas of high-value agricultural land. So absolutely, the major concern around the impact on agricultural land and production, and that's where, you know, the regulations are important, as well as, I guess, the bargaining power of the landholder in that, being able to work with the company to ensure that whatever they're doing on that property is done in a way that's sensitive to the landholders' farming operations and minimises the footprint on that agricultural production.
So, but from the experience that you've had, there are, you know, win-win situations for the individual farmers, the company, and the broader community.
There are definitely win-wins, and I think, you know, in the 10 to 15 years experience that we have in Queensland, in coal seam gas in particular, we've seen many of them. The coal seam gas process requires the production of what's called associated water, groundwater that's extracted as part of the production of gas. What we've seen happen with that particular resource, which was essentially a waste product of the coal seam gas process, we've seen companies invest in the treatment of that water and the beneficial reuse of that water and giving it to landholders so that they can utilise that water to, you know, enhance their farming operations. That's a great example of where a waste product essentially from an industrial process has been turned into a win-win mutual benefit situation with landholders.
Is the Commission a unique organisation here in Australia?
I believe that the Gasfield Commission in Queensland is the only independent statutory body that exists in relation to promoting and facilitating coexistence between rural communities, landholders and the gas industry. We've certainly over the years fielded many inquiries from other states about our jurisdiction and how we function, but I believe we are the only one, at least in the resources sector area.
And with all the interest that we're seeing, I mean, not only here in Western Australia, you know, some of the biggest players, even this week we've spoken about BHP investing in a windmill in the southwest of Western Australia, and Inpex, Qantas, ANZ looking around the wheat belt here in WA looking for carbon farming projects, and of course green hydrogen, which is very topical here too, and in Queensland as well.
Absolutely.
Do you see that model can apply to those different industries to make sure there's that harmony between the farming families and the big corporates that turn up in town?
Look, I think anywhere where there's a competing interest at play, independent entity such as the Commission can play a key role. You know, we really focus on leading the conversation around coexistence in Queensland, getting information to people, facilitating relationships, facilitating the discussion. We're by no means a regulator in any way, shape or form. So I think that's what you find in many of these instances when you've got that change happening in a community, you need the honest broker, you need the group that can impart the information from an independent perspective, independent of government, of the companies, and hopefully with a level of trust so that the conversation can be a positive one and one based on fact, not one based on lack of information and fear, which was our experience 12 to 10 years ago in coal seam gas in Queensland, and is often the experience where a new player is coming into an area.
Warwick, really great to get your insights from on the other side of the country. Appreciate it.
No problems. Thanks for your time.
Warwick Squire, he is the CEO of the Gasfields Commission Queensland. 28 past 12.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Just before the news at 1, off to Mount Barker to check in with the cattle market today. Tracy Kilner going through those details for you. But talking about sheep and lambs now, because the lamb slaughter rates here in Western Australian meatworks have dropped 43% in recent weeks due to COVID-related staffing problems. Meat and Livestock Australia's Stephen Bignall says WA is following the same path as the eastern states Omicron wave.
So what we've seen in the last 2 weeks is that WA's slaughter of sheep and lambs has fallen 43%. That's tied to an increase in the rate of COVID in the state and the sort of issues that come from that and the isolations and people having to take leave and days off.
Has that had a significant impact on prices?
We have seen in the trade lamb prices over the same price. So since the middle of March, prices have come back 140 cents per kilo from 822 to 682, which is a fall of 17%.
This seems awfully familiar. Feels like what took place over east a couple of months ago. Is that accurate? And can we expect things to take a similar trajectory?
Yeah, so in the East Coast, we obviously had the same Omicron outbreak and the issues, the same issues that are around people having to isolate close contacts. And that lasted a month in the East Coast, and we really recovered after 5 weeks. Expect sort of a similar situation in WA, provided the virus plays out the same. The only thing I would caveat is that in 2 weeks' time, we're going to hit a run of four-day weeks. And we know that in the last 2 years, slaughter's fallen by around 25% when we've hit those shorter weeks.
Would we expect then a further fall over that period, or perhaps a compensation from the slowdown that's already come? What do you expect to happen next?
If the impact of the slaughter, of the COVID isolations and workforce issues was the same length as the East Coast, it would be easing as we come into Easter, and then so it would be keep easing and increasing back to 100%. But if we do get those 3-4 day weeks, then we could see periods of protracted shorter slaughter at the end of when the COVID issue has passed.
Based on what you've seen over East, in the months since that initial wave, have there been any further disruptions to meatworks there?
There was for the cattle. So if we look at the cattle, but they obviously have been hit by floods in that Queensland Northern Rivers region where there are processing plants. But if we look more broadly at what's happened in the lamb space, they are continuing to operate at last year or above 2020, 2021 levels since they've sort of come out of that COVID slump.
How accurate are those numbers that you're looking at here? Do they reflect a statewide trend?
Yeah, so we get those numbers from our NLRS team, and that's a voluntary survey that goes out each week, and that is a voluntary survey of processing plants or of what their slaughter numbers are.
If you were a seller dealing in trade lambs, what sort of things would you be keeping in mind for the weeks to come?
If I was a seller, it would be something that would be on my mind. I think we always know and prepare for this Easter period, and I think just in the 2 weeks before, it will be up to the seller whether they do want to sell into the market where the prices are at the moment, or they hold out till post-Easter if they can.
Do you anticipate a bit of a backlog effect in some of the markets for that slaughtered meat owing to the slowdown?
So what we have seen in the East Coast is we had a bigger cohort of lambs last year, and in Victoria there were processing issues in the back end of last year, restrictions of up to 80% of processors, and then we obviously saw the COVID stuff at the start of this year. So the big cohort of lambs hasn't necessarily hit the market by the end of March that we might have expected, and we will see that sort of it's not a backlog. It just means that there's a smoothing across the year. So the seasonality, the big peak in sort of spring and summer, has just been extended out into August, and we expect similar things in WA to occur.
Meat and Livestock Australia's Market Information Manager Stephen Bignall with Angus McIntosh. 28 to 1 here on the Country Hour. Jonathan Beale is here now. What's happening in the headlines, Jonathan?
Thanks, Belinda. A 42-year-old homeless man has been sentenced to life with a 20-year minimum for the murder of another homeless man on Christmas Eve in 2019. Simon Sharp was found guilty by a Supreme Court jury of repeatedly stabbing Frederick John Merton, whose body was found in Adachi Park in Ascot, where both men were living in their cars. The court heard the first stab wound was inflicted from behind, while the remaining six were likely inflicted while Mr. Merton was lying on the ground. With time already served, Sharp will first be eligible for release in 2039. The Premier says the state government is yet to make a decision on easing mask mandates. Masks are currently required for people aged 8 and over in indoor public spaces, including on public transport and in hospitals and aged care facilities. Mark McGowan says the removal of mask mandates will depend on health advice. And WA has recorded another 3 historical COVID-19 deaths. The deaths date back to the 5th of April. 7,998 new infections have been recorded today, and 256 people are in hospital with the virus. More news, Belinda, at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Jonathan. 27 to 1. And this hour, talking about when big business comes to town, to small rural and regional communities. They can be the billionaires, they can be the big corporates, as we've discussed here on the Country Hour this week. Qantas, ANZ, Inpex, taking a look around the wheat belt, looking for farmers who may be interested in getting involved in some carbon farming projects. And the other one we spoke about this week, BHP, looking around Kojonup to establish that wind farm project. So how do you negotiate with these big players? What's in it for you? And on the text, this from Brad, these are the exact problems that we are trying to deal with in the Wheat Belt. Corporates are really killing small communities. This from Tony in Denmark, decarbonising is vital if we plan to allow our planet to recover. Why not build wind farms on already cleared farmlands nearby main feed power lines? There is so much open space available with potential and carbon credit income to the rural sector. And this from Neville, I have no problems with properties being snapped up by Australian companies, but maybe they can lease the land to the northern farmers in the area so the land itself is not lost for grazing. What do you think? Let me know on the text 0448 922 604. Very shortly, catching up with Julie Collins, who is the Federal Shadow Agriculture Minister, and really keen to hear her thoughts around the possible policies, Labor's policies for Australia's $81 billion agriculture industry. It's going to be interesting to get that insight, so don't miss that conversation shortly here on the Country Hour. 25 to 1, off to the Bureau of Meteorology. Luke Huntington, how's it looking around northern and eastern parts of the state?
Yeah, it's pretty quiet at the moment. There's just a chance of a shower and thunderstorms over the far northern Kimberley today. There's just one that's just popped up near Columbaroo, so there'll probably just be some more in the afternoon and evening. And heading into tomorrow, similar conditions through the Kimberley as well, so just a chance of an afternoon shower or thunderstorm over that far northwestern Kimberley. And similar conditions as you get into the Saturday period. There could be another chance of a shower or thunderstorm over that northern Kimberley, but pretty much clear throughout the Pilbara and the interior region. Throughout the eastern goldfields and Eucla, there could be just a chance of a mid-level thunderstorm through that area, but there wouldn't be too much precipitation with that. Heading into Sunday, the showers and thunderstorms clear out of the Kimberley, but we do have a cloud band just ahead of a cold front through the Eucla and eastern goldfields, south interior there. So we could see sort of around the 5 to 10 millimetres in that sort of rain shower band through that area. And heading into Monday is a little bit uncertain at this stage, but there is a low pressure system to go across the southern half of the state, and we could see some further falls through the Eucla and the Goldfields region heading into the south interior.
And then in the southwest land division, how are conditions this afternoon and what's on the way?
Yeah, so we do have a ridge dominating the south of the state there. So it's directing northeasterly winds across the southwest land division. So pretty clear skies for the rest of today. We do have a cold front approaching the southwest tomorrow. So the actual cold front won't go across the southwest capes until late tomorrow afternoon and then get into the remaining parts during the evening period. But it does look like there will be some showers just ahead of the front itself. So we could see some showers develop around coastal parts between Kalbarri and Windy Harbour during the morning period, and then pushing through pretty much south of Kalbarri to Katanning across to Hopetoun during the afternoon and evening. There's also just a chance of some isolated thunderstorms ahead of the cold front as well, pretty much south of the wheat belt there. And again, those thunderstorms would produce much precipitation with them at all. Ahead of the front, we are seeing some quite hot and windy conditions, so it looks like we're going to have a fire weather warning for the eastern parts of the central wheat belt with a severe fire danger through that region, and above average temperatures through the Esperance area and then eastern parts of the Great Southern and wheat belt area with temperatures in the low 30s. So that cold front contracts east on Saturday, and we're just left in an onshore flow, so we'll see further showers along the south coast. Those showers will clear quite early from the west coast there. So the heaviest falls with the front for tomorrow will be along that south coast between Augusta and Albany, maybe up to 10 millimetres, with maybe 1 to 5 millimetres for that remaining part I mentioned. Heading into Sunday, we do actually have another cold front moving up from the southwest. So that'll move over southwestern parts of the state during the day. There could be a little bit more rainfall associated with that. So it could be 10 to 15 millimetres along that southwest coast and maybe 1 to 5 millimetres pretty much south of Durian Bay to Katanning across to Esperance there. And then it gets a little bit uncertain on the Monday period. That cold front sort of, there's a low pressure system associated with that cold front, and it sort of possibly stalls over southeastern parts of the state, sort of in the Esperance, Southern Goldfields area. So if that happens, there could be a potential for some moderate heavy falls in that area. At the moment on the forecast, we'll be putting rainfall ranges in the range of 15 to 20 millimetres, but just depending on what happens, there could be some higher rainfall totals in that area early next week.
And Luke, this afternoon, any warnings?
The only warning is a strong wind warning, and it covers the southwest of the state, Bunbury, Lawn, Albany and Esperance, and we've also got the eastern parts of the state, Eucla, and this is for tomorrow.
Thanks so much, Luke. Appreciate that. 20 to 1, taking a look at the rainfall figures now with Richard Hudson.
Yeah, not much to get through at all. In the northern and eastern forecast districts, the only rain was around in the Kimberley, where Truscott received 14 mils, and then in the Pilbara region, De Grey recorded 10 mils, but that was over 2 days. But we just keep hearing a bit about just how much rain has been falling in the eastern states. Again, more rain is falling in New South Wales. Guess what Sydney's annual average rainfall is, Belle? Just a rough guess.
Average rainfall for, sorry, what was the question, Richard? I never listened to you.
I know you don't. It's 1,213.4 millimetres.
I was going to say that.
I know you were. That's from 150 years worth of records. And as of 9 a.m. today, it's at 1,226.8 millimetres. So in other words, we're into week one of the fourth month of the year, and already Sydney's got its annual rainfall total. And I think they're getting a fair bit of rain today. There could be a flooding, all sorts of things going on there. We've had some great rain in the last few weeks for large parts of Western Australia's grain-growing region, and that's actually prompted a lot of the farmers to get seeding a bit earlier than the traditional Anzac Day starting point. Ken Stone farms just west of Kojonup, and he's already about a quarter of the way through his seeding program.
So we started on about the 20th of March, seeding some long-season winter wheat, and we started some canola as we got closer to April. So about the 27th or 28th, we started on canola with some long-season 6-series varieties.
Did that coincide with a bit of the rain coming through in your area? How much did you get?
In March, we had a couple of events that got us up to about 25 mils or so, which was sort of given us enough confidence to get into it. Since then, we've had a few more events and we're up to about 40 millimetres for the year so far. We've got to be careful not to, what we wish for with rain in these areas. Last year, we got wet early and stayed wet the whole way through. So for us to have just enough moisture to get crops out of the ground at this point's probably pretty good for us. Could have handled a little bit more on the weekend, but yeah, no complaints.
How much further along your program do you have to go before everything's in?
Oh, fair way. We'd probably be about 25% of the way through now. So yeah, we're nearly halfway through the canola. And then yeah, the plan is we'll pull up and catch up on a few other jobs and get into barley around Anzac Day or something like that if we get the canola finished off before then.
Is it too early to make much of a prognosis for your expectations this year? What sort of things are on your mind?
My feeling was that we're going to get belted soon with big input costs and a crop that's not worth much or doesn't produce as much as we want, and that'll hurt. But I think the Ukraine situation might delay that a year or two, but I am nervous about what's coming. I think we should be okay for this year. A lot of inputs were secured earlier at good pricing, and the grain prices seem to be holding up. So I think, yeah, fingers crossed this year should be okay. There'll be a crook one coming up, I think.
Kent Stone, who farms near Kojonup, talking to Angus McIntosh about seeding this season. 17 to 1 here on the Country Hour. And with the federal election expected to be officially called within days, Labor is keeping tight-lipped about its plans for Australia's $81 billion agriculture sector. It's yet to commit on live exports, dairy regulation, or its plans for the agriculture visa and the farm workforce. But Shadow Agriculture Minister Julie Collins says she's been talking with farmers and Labor will have more details to announce before the election. National Rural reporter Kath Sullivan sat down with Julie Collins in Canberra this week to ask the would-be Agriculture Minister how many policies Labor has for the agriculture portfolio.
Well, we've outlined some of our policies to date in relation to agriculture. Obviously, there's our Powering Australia climate change policy, which will create jobs. Five out of six of those 600,000 jobs in regional Australia. They'll, of course, benefit farmers with real action on climate change. We've, of course, have outlined our regional housing policy, our regional telecommunications policy, our Jobs and Skills Australia.
But how many policies relate directly to the production of livestock and horticulture and cropping?
Well, clearly the issues that farmers raise with me that are most important to them, number one is always climate change, because there's no doubt that climate is impacting on what's going on our farms. So I think
that climate impacts
farmers and their ability to produce.
So you're saying that climate change is the number one issue for Australian agriculture?
What I'm saying is it's one of the issues that farmers raise with me regularly. They also raise with me biosecurity. They raise with me labour shortages. They raise a whole heap of issues with me when I'm talking to them.
Okay, so what would a Labor government do in terms of biosecurity in Australia?
Well, we are concerned about the reports from the Inspector General and the Auditor in relation to biosecurity and its failings. And we saw, obviously, during the global pandemic, human biosecurity's failures. So we think that we need a better, stronger biosecurity system, and we'll have more to say about that.
You could potentially be the Agriculture Minister in a number of weeks. Isn't it time you told us what you're saying rather than saying you'll have more to say?
Well, we've outlined quite a few things at the National Farmers Federation in relation to the leader's speech. We will have more to say during the campaign. We'll be offering a very clear alternative.
At the last election, Labor had a policy to put a floor in the farm gate milk price. Is that still Labor's policy?
Well, last election we had a policy in relation to getting the ACCC to look at that issue. We have been talking to dairy farmers and we'll be making announcements about what we want to do in coming weeks.
Yes or no, at the last election, Labor had a policy to phase out the live export of sheep. Is that still Labor's policy?
Well, I'm not going to be making policy announcements in the interview today, Kath, and we're talking to people about what our policies might look like. We've obviously been working very hard over the last 3 years consulting with the community and with dairy farmers.
What do you say to those farm groups who say that you're not engaged on the topic, that you're more interested in defending Tasmania and representing Tasmanians?
I haven't heard that being said, but I'm obviously a very proud Tasmanian. I was involved early on working for the state government in relation to Tasmanian irrigation. Of course, the former federal Labor government and the state Labor government invested $500 million, and we've seen that transform Tasmania. What we need to see, I think, nationally is we need to see more value adding on our products if we're going to get to the $100 billion of ag by 2030. We all need to be working together, and people know that I'm very consultative and I'm talking to people.
Okay, you said that you've heard a lot from industry about labour shortages. What would a Labor government do to address the worker shortages on farm?
Well, we've said that we will have Jobs and Skills Australia, which will be full of experts working with industry, working with the sector, working with unions, talking to them about how we have the skilled Australians for the jobs of today and the jobs in 5 years and the jobs in 10 years. We also obviously have our fee-free TAFE places and the additional university places so that we can train more Australians. Obviously, in the short term, we do need to rely on overseas labour, and certainly, as we have outlined, we do support farmers trying to get more people on farms, more workers on farms. We are concerned that so much fruit and vegetables are rotting on farm, and we need to do everything we can to get them off.
How much fruit and vegetables do you think is rotting because there aren't workers?
Well, certainly last year we were told it was around 60 million, and
is
we hear
dollars?
All the time. Yes. And we hear all the time from farmers that there are significant labour shortages. It's estimated, I understand, between 10 and 20,000 workers on farms that we need to get here.
So is the ag visa the answer?
Well, I think it's become pretty clear the ag visa is not working. There are no workers on farms under the ag visa. I think it's also pretty clear that we've got two ministers in the current government that can't agree on what that looks like. We've had one country sign an MOU. We don't know the details of that. So we don't actually know what the ag visa looks like. The ag visa, as outlined by the minister, doesn't really exist, is the problem.
What isn't clear is what Labor would do if it wins government with the ag visa. Would you see it abolished, or would you try and rework it to fit in with Labor's values?
What we want to do, obviously, is, and we have been doing, is talking to the sector, talking to the National Farmers Federation, talking to farmers about what exactly it is that they need and how we can do that, and how we can also protect workers. We've made one announcement already, which is about the licensing of labour hire companies. That will ensure that some of those practices that have been exploiting some workers on farms is removed, but we clearly need to do more. We also had the government talk about a pathway to permanency, but we haven't seen from the government what that looks like. So we'll be announcing more in the campaign, but we really do want to consult with people carefully about it and get it right.
Just on labour issues as well, it's recently come to light how some foreign workers are taking home as little as $100 in cash pay at the end of a week due to deductions taken out by their employer. Now, that's in line with the government's own guidelines. Do you have a problem with that?
I do have an issue with that. I think that people should be getting a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. And that's what we mean by making sure that when we bring people in from overseas, that we look after them. That they're getting decent wages, and that
So how would you do that?
Proper registration of labour hire companies will be a start to that, making sure that people get a fair day's pay for a fair day's work.
Would you consider putting a floor in the deductions so that foreign workers did have more than $100 take-home pay?
Well, we'll look at that detail in government, but we really are concerned that, people are coming here. Australia, unfortunately, there are a few rotten eggs that are, leaving us with a bad reputation.
But these aren't rotten eggs. These are approved employers under the federal government scheme, and they're in line with the seasonal worker program employer guidelines. Would you seek to change that?
As I said, we'll have more to say on the detail in coming weeks. We are concerned about what's happening.
Aren't you concerned that if you have more to say in coming weeks on everything, that people will just tune out?
I think people are interested in hearing what an alternative is, and I think that we've
That's seen, why I'm asking.
Yeah, we've seen that, and certainly we'll be very clear between now and Election Day on what our plans are.
Do you want to be the Federal Agriculture Minister?
I'm loving being the Shadow Agriculture Minister, and I would look forward to it in government. Obviously, that's up to the leader. But as I said earlier, people have been incredibly generous with me as I've been going around the country talking to people. I live in a regional seat. I've got lots of primary producers in my electorate. I think it's a great portfolio.
Shadow Agriculture Minister Julie Collins, what did you make of that at 8 minutes to one? This from Neville, re-Labor, what a load of mud. Neville says the main thing I hear at the moment is the cost of inputs and what the government might do next to stuff the markets again, re the live exports. What do you think? Let me know on the text 0448 922 604. Peter Boyle is a farmer from York but also has property at Quereting in Northam, and 20% of his farm business is the live sheep trade and the rest is dedicated to cropping. Peter, what's your reaction to what you've just heard from the Shadow Agriculture Minister?
I was disgusted, mortified, afraid, and really worried.
Why?
Because she said nothing, and so that when it comes to the crunch, she can do whatever she likes because she hasn't committed to anything. And she can say, I never said anything, so she can shut the thing down. She can make it more difficult with the labour side of it as well, which is crucial for us. It's all bull dust. There's nothing. It's just dust floating in the air. There's no power to it, no conviction. I was absolutely flabbergasted.
One area of interest for you is obviously the future of the sheep export trade, which makes up a significant part of your farming business. At the last election, Labor went to that election with a policy of phasing out the export of sheep. How do you feel about the future of the industry after listening to the Shadow Agriculture Minister?
I'd say that you don't know, but she's not giving us any hope, that's for sure. I'd say she's going to phase it out, but she won't let us know. It'll be wishy-washy until after the election, and then she can do what she likes because she didn't commit to anything. That's the way it appears to be going.
And what impact does that have on your business as far as planning goes?
Well, we start purchasing sheep and make decisions about which paddocks we have for pasture and fertiliser applications, everything now. That's all being done. And with the slow movement of boats this year, we'll be caught short with quite a few sheep on hand. So it'll be very difficult in the short term.
And, I mean, you know, for the last few years now, there's been a moratorium on sheep exports anyway, just in that middle part of the year, so the Northern Hemisphere summer, where those sheep aren't allowed to go to the Middle East for, you know, three-ish sort of months. What impact has that had on your business?
Initially, it was quite a bit. And so we've adjusted to that, but it still makes the business a lot more difficult to run and organise. And this living on tender hooks is the Liberals have made more and more regulation that's come in, and they're also probably trying to phase it out through regulation, not anything else. That gets more and more difficult, as you heard yesterday from Rekwa. Life's not easy for them.
No, and then obviously, I mean, even at the moment, in the sale yards, a lot of the processors are dealing with their own COVID isolation issues, so a lot of staff not working. So they're not as active in the sale yards. And then you're heading up to the moratorium period. So there's quite a few challenges for those who are in the sheep trade at the moment.
Yes, well, people will be having to carry sheep on that they were hoping to get rid of. And lambs will become hoggets and all those sort of things as well, which that then does become expensive.
Peter, what did you want to hear from either party, really? I mean, obviously the sheep trade, the live sheep trade is a particular issue for you. But what else are you hoping to hear from any party in the lead up to the federal election? What's the key issues for you?
Well, they're all running behind carbon and all this saying, oh, no, we're going to make it better, we're going to look after the climate. But they're not, nobody's committed to anything, and they're using that as a smokescreen to do nothing else. So that's what we would like, some strong conviction. We are going to support and encourage live shipping. We're going to bring more workers into the country, because everywhere we go, we can't get parts, we can't get mechanics, we can't get staff to help us. CBH is short, no truck drivers. Everywhere we go, we need people in the country, but all they do is talk about it and do nothing. They need to open it up.
So you're not feeling really inspired by any side of politics at this point?
No.
So where does that leave you?
Worried and just really knuckle down and just try and do the best we can under the circumstances.
Peter, good to get your thoughts. I appreciate you being here on the Country Hour today. Thank you.
Thank you.
One of the state's big sheep producers, York farmer Peter Boyle. 3 minutes to one.
Hello, I'm Sally Sara. Join me for The World Today. The federal opposition calls on Russian diplomats in Australia to be expelled amid growing evidence of war crimes by Russian forces in Ukraine. Have you had your COVID booster on time? Health officials say 2 million Australians are overdue. And truck drivers furious over a cut to the fuel tax credit. They say they weren't consulted. Those stories and more coming up on The World Today.
Off to Mount Barker now for the results of the cattle market. Tracy Kilner, how did it go?
Total yarding today was 605. That's down 141 from last week. Also, just like to advise everybody, there'll be no sale next week, the 14th, and our next sale will be after Easter, the 21st. So I'll just start with the... We had a good sale for the young cattle, not so good for the processor and trade cattle. A mixed quality yarding was offered, with quality weaner calves gaining in all weight categories and highlighted by Angus heifers topping the market at 748 cents a kilo. Limited trade and processor cattle were presented, with one processor not operating, these categories eased. Weaner steers again dominated the yarding, with heavyweights over 330 kilos gaining, with feedlot demand selling from 608 to 674 cents a kilo. Feeder and restocker buyers were selective on quality, paying from 580 to 672 cents for medium weight calves, and lightweight sold from 562 up to 714 cents for the better quality calves. Heavy weaner heifers made 572 to 748 cents, medium weights returned 492 to 686 cents, and lightweights from 476 to 616 cents, depending on quality. Yearling steers eased, selling from 526 to 580 cents. A small yarding of heavy prime cows eased on last week, selling from 280 to 300 cents. Medium weight cows made 326 cents, and stock cows returned 250 to 388 cents, with most sales heading back to the paddock. Heavy bulls eased 20 cents, selling for 280 to 300 cents. Medium weights returned 358 cents, and lightweight bullies returned 356 to 466 cents, depending on quality. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you for that, Tracy. This just in from Laura in the Midwest. The Shadow Ag Minister seems out of her depth. Ag under federal Labor government is doomed. Don't want another Morrison term, but certainly don't want Labor either. Many in ag are too busy counting record profits to be actively fighting for their industry, and it feels like a fight is on its way. Thank you for that, Laura. News time, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.